You're listening to a podcast from the Brookings Institution.
We're delighted to see you all on this day before a three-day weekend as we talk about a global overview of the growing internal displacement crisis. Our project has worked with IDPs for about 20 years, trying to raise awareness and promote the rights of those who've been displaced within the borders of their own countries. Actually, I think if you look back over the past 50 years, I would say this is one of two signal human rights achievements in the world, a recognition that people displaced within their country have rights, that sovereignty does not give absolute permission to governments to do what they will to their people. The second big achievement, I would say, is the movement against impunity and the development of accountability and justice mechanisms. It's thus a bit distressing as we look at the report for today to find that after 20 years, the number of IDPs has reached an all-time high. Now, of course, some of this increase may be because we're now counting better. 20 years ago, our statistics were pretty poor. But nonetheless, the fact that the number of IDPs has continued to increase, even as awareness of their rights has come, is certainly concerning. We'll hear today from Frank Smith from the Internal Displacement Monitoring Center about the number and the methodology of counting some of these IDPs. But just to put this in perspective, UNHCR estimates there are about 15 million refugees in the world, that is people who've crossed an international border, and another 5 million or so, according to UNRWA, displaced Palestinian refugees. But the number of IDPs, more than 28 million, many of them more vulnerable than refugees because they're closer to the violence, and as we see today in Syria, providing assistance and protection to them is very difficult. This isn't in any way to diminish the plight of refugees who have clear, immediate, identifiable needs. But it is a little striking after 20 years to think refugees have a big UN agency, United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees, Palestinians have UNRWA, and still for IDPs, the question of protection and assistance depends as much on persuasion and trying to get international agencies to take responsibility for the plight of those displaced. So I think it's timely indeed to step back and say, how are we as an international community doing with respect to IDPs in terms of providing for protection and assistance for an ever more vulnerable group of people? Today's discussion will begin with Frank Smith from the Internal Displacement Monitoring Center, who is head of the Department for Middle East, Europe, Caucasus, and Asia. That sounds like a lot to do. He's worked for 15 years on research and advocacy with a number of organizations such as Amnesty International, Oxfam GP, World Vision, et cetera. He'll give us an overview of the global overview, which is a document, I think, Frank, that we all depend on. We look forward to it coming out every year and to reading your analysis of the patterns of movements and so forth. Then we'll turn to Nancy Lindborg, and we're delighted to have you here, Nancy, who's Assistant Administrator of the Bureau for Conflict and Humanitarian Assistance of USAID. And within the U.S. government, it's USAID that's primarily responsible for assisting people who are displaced within the borders of their country. She's well known to many of us here in the international community for her many years of service with Mercy Corps. Welcome. We're glad to have you. And then we'll turn to Elizabeth Hopkins, who's Acting Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for Population, Refugees, and Migration. Elizabeth is actually stepping in for Ann Richard, who'd planned to be here today, but is stuck in Miami after returning from Colombia and Ecuador, where, among other things, she was looking into the situation of IDPs. Prior to her appointment as Deputy Assistant Secretary, she was Deputy Chief of Mission in Jordan, has worked mostly on the Middle East issues, which is certainly relevant to looking at internal displacement today. Finally, we'll turn to Joel Charney, who's Vice President for Humanitarian Policy and Practice at Interaction, also well known to many of us for his work with Refugees International, Oxfam, UNDP, and is well known in our circles as a bit of a passionate advocate, I would say, Joel. So we'll turn to Frank, and what can you say, Anna? Frank, tell us about IDPs this year.
Lovely. Thanks a lot. Well, just first a little bit about my organization, IDMC, the Internal Displacement Monitoring Center. I'm not sure if all of you know about them, about who we are. We were set up in 1998. By the Norwegian Refugee Council at the time when the guiding principles were adopted to monitor how the international community was doing in relation to these new principles, that guiding principles that were adopted, and to report back to the international community with a view of trying to allow people to get a sort of baseline of what was happening and to improve their performance in relation to interventions on IDPs. Since then, we've increased our sort of research, analysis, and advocacy on the issue, and we've increased our sort of capacity. But every year, we issue the global overview of the situation of conflict and violence affected displaced people in the world, and that is basically just what it says on the tin, if you like, a broad overview of the situation of internal displacement as it affects conflict, violence, and human rights affected populations around the world. Recently, we've also started to monitor displacement caused by natural hazards, and we've been issuing the Global Estimates Report, which looks at displacement, you know, induced by natural hazards. But today I'm going to focus on conflict-affected displaced communities, which is captured in the global overview. But if you want to know anything about natural hazards induced displacement, I would invite you to look at the website and get in touch with us if you've got any questions. So a little bit about how we do this, what our methodology is, and our approach to crunching out these figures and making these assessments. We basically compile and assess different data sets that are already available, so secondary data gathering from the UN, governments, civil society organizations, and then we cross-check this with information from civil society partners, from missions to the field, so we talk to IDPs themselves, and from media reports and other sorts of reports that are coming out. And then we use that to estimate the scale and the sort of patterns of displacement at a particular time in a particular country. So the availability and quality of data varies from context to context, obviously, and that's why we need to critically assess the different data sets that are available and look at the different methodologies that are used in data gathering in order to come to an estimation of the actual figures. And then we also look at issues like census data, population flows and movements, and we come up to our sort of estimation at the end of the year. So what does internal displacement look like in 2012? Well, as was mentioned, the total number of displaced people in the world in 2012 rose by 2.4 million to 28.8 million, and that's the highest figure ever recorded by IDMC in its work over the last 15 years. Around 6.5 million people were newly displaced in 2012, and that was almost twice as many new displacements as in 2011. 3.5 million people were newly displaced in 2011. So we've got a sort of increased tendency there. And as Beth mentioned, if you compare the amount of refugees to IDPs, and there's a little chart in the book, in the overview, and on the table at the back there. Sorry, I don't have it on me. I do somewhere, but I've lost it. You will see that the stark contrast between the number of IDPs and the number of refugees in the world. So that's certainly something to think about in terms of, if we look at displacement as a category of vulnerability, where some of the focus and attention should be in relation to the need and the scale of the problem. So that's an interesting one for us all to consider. 2.1 million IDPs were reported to have returned in 2012, including 1.3 million returnees in sub-Saharan Africa. Returns are always a very difficult one, because when people move, they move as a result of an emergency en masse. But when they return, those returns seem to be in trickles rather than en masse, other than sort of when they're not organised, if you like, through specific agencies. Over 90% of countries monitored by IDMCs have populations in protracted displacement, and that's something very interesting for us. The vulnerabilities are different. You can't say they're less vulnerable. They're vulnerable in a different way. Some of these people have been caught in displacement for, you know, decades. Now, arguably, are they displaced? Are they not? Well, they still have vulnerabilities that prevent them from, you know, enjoying their full rights as citizens. Okay, so why the increase in the figures over the last year? Well, the increase is mainly the result of large population movements in several countries in Africa and the Middle East. Conflicts in Syria and the Democratic Republic of Congo were responsible for around half the new displacements, with 2.4 million and 1 million respectively, while an estimated 500,000 fled their homes in Sudan and India. So the largest regional increase in the number of displaced people in 2012 was the Middle East and North Africa, with 2.5 million people forced to flee their homes, again, most of those in Syria. So now there's almost 6 million IDPs in the Middle East, and that's a rise of 40% from the 2011 figures. So clearly the situation is, very, very grave there. And if you consider the situation, you know, 2, 3 years ago, 4 years ago, where the Middle East was not really registering, you know, very highly on the displacement figure, certainly on our monitoring, you can see how these situations change rapidly. 2011, there was a massive spike because of the conflicts linked to the Arab Spring, and that sort of, you know, snowballed massively as a result of the situations, the new situations emerging in Syria, but also the unresolved situations in Iraq. And, you know, Yemen, what have you. The region with the highest number of IDPs, though, worldwide, remains sub-Saharan Africa, 10.4 million people in 2012. And this represents an increase on the 2011 figures, and it reverses a downward trend. So basically, over the last few years, since 2004, we saw a steady decrease in the number of IDPs in Africa. That trend has been reversed. And it's consistent with the findings from the Heidelberg Institute's conflict barometer that suggests that there were more highly violent conflicts in Africa in 2012 than at any other time since they started monitoring conflict across the world in 1945. So that's something to be concerned about. Colombia continues to be the country with the highest IDP figures. Government's estimates these to be at 9 million, civil society at 5.5 million. So again, and there's a mix of protracted displacements and new displacements there, worth bearing in mind. So despite this seemingly bleak picture, there are some positive trends and that speak to the successes that, if you like, we've had, the international community has had, in trying to address some of these issues. The most significant success for us, as Beth mentioned, was the adoption of the African Union Convention on the Protection and Assistance of IDPs, commonly known as the Kampala Convention. And this is the world's first legally binding convention instrument for the protection of IDPs. We've got the guiding principles, but these are just guiding principles. This is actually a convention that civil society and others can use to actually hold governments to account for the implementation of the rights of IDPs. 25 countries worldwide have adopted IDP laws and policies in the last 15 years. And in 2012 alone, policies and instruments were progressed and adopted in countries such as Afghanistan, DRC, Mexico, Philippines and Georgia. So there is that is a very positive trend, we feel, to provide the legal protective frameworks for IDPs. And then there are moves to by the UN. There is at the beginnings of a recognition that the gap between the humanitarian and development sides branches of the organization needs to be bridged, and the UN Secretary General's framework on ending displacement in the aftermath of conflict, which aims to support a more coherent and predictable UN response towards durable solutions is a very positive step. It's going to be piloted, or it is being piloted in Kyrgyzstan, Afghanistan, Côte d'Ivoire, and it brings together the different agencies to look at developing, you know, plans for addressing IDP issues and refugee issues in a coherent and sustainable manner at all phases of displacement. I'm just going to go through the common challenges very quickly, if that's okay, and then I'll pass it on. So there are a number of common challenges that we still face as a community working on displacement. One of them is the situation of access. It's very difficult to access IDPs, not only to do a humanitarian response, but also to try and get a true measure of the situation on the ground. And this was a challenge in Syria. No one could get in. OCHA couldn't get in. We couldn't do the initial assessments. That means the international community wasn't aware of the scale of the problem. That means we're not sure what the protection needs are or what the size of the problem is, and that sort of hampered initial responses, and in fact it hampered, it prevented a lot of people from recognizing internal displacement as a problem at the outset. People spoke about refugees and the dead and the political intractability of the situation. There's a need to also recognize that displacement is not something that happens at the humanitarian phase. And this is not only with conflict-affected displacement, but with, climate change-induced displacement, natural hazards-induced displacement. There is an initial phase where everybody has to move, but you can't just protect them until the conflict is ended, because they're still not home, if you like. They still have needs, and they still need support to get home. So assuming that initial humanitarian phase is all you need to respond to, rather than to respond to that secondary phase, that early recovery phase, the return, the reintegration, to ensure that the vulnerabilities that were maybe exposed, that they were exposed to at the initial, when the initial event happened, either violent event or violent climatic or natural disaster, it is very important to ensure that people are supported throughout the displacement cycle and not just for the humanitarian phase. And I think maybe the way we organise our work, not only in civil society but in governments and the UN, that doesn't really lend itself readily to addressing that full range of needs. And again, given the fact that 90% of IDPs are locked in protracted displacement situation, we need to look at social policies, government social policies, and how they integrate the issue of internally displaced people, rather than look at it as a parallel thing that's just, with its own response mechanism. It needs to be integrated within broader government structures and social policies, and obviously the international community and civil society have a role to play there. Okay, I think my time's up, so I'm going to cut it there, and I'll deal with anything at the questions time. Sorry, Nancy, I took up
Thanks,
some
Frank.
Of your time.
Please, Nancy.
Thanks, Beth. And thanks, Frank. I mean, I really want to commend Frank, on the report that you've done. I think it's invaluable, and I think particularly the very vivid presentation of the sobering statistics are a great service to the community. And, you know, we're here today in part to reflect on that very sobering increase, particularly of IDPs to violent conflict. And this is, something that I think we have been keenly aware of for the past year, and to see it all put into a stark figure like that is helpful. I'm glad you mentioned some of the challenge that you did. When I think of the conflict issues and over the past year, the access concerns that we've had, when you take Somalia plus the two areas in Sudan plus northern Mali plus Syria, I think this is one of the most compelling and difficult challenges that we face as a humanitarian community. And it really deserves, I think, considerable additional effort and thought on how to address that, because it's everything from the ability to understand the needs, to provide the needs, and we're seeing over and over again that it's in those areas that we see the greatest humanitarian tragedies. We're also, we look with great concern at the increase of IDPs from natural disasters. You note the 32-something million. I'll let Frank do this, all the statistics. And that 98% of those are in developing countries. You know, we map that against something we talked about just a couple weeks ago here, the rise and increase of natural disasters, the weather impacts from climate change, and this presents a worrying combination, and our belief that that trend will only continue and to be more severe. So with both of those trends in mind, I mean, we're looking at AID both at how to put together humanitarian responses that enable us to be ever more flexible, particularly in places where you have rapidly changing IDP situations. So for in Eastern Congo, for example, we're working with some of our international development partners to do these rapid response mechanisms, so that very flexible funding is available after a quick assessment is done, because we know, and many of you in this audience probably know, that in the DRC you have pockets of IDPs that shift about. And so you need to have mechanisms and partners who are agile enough to be able to address those kinds of movements. We're also, you know, looking at all the ways in which we are able to get into areas that are difficult to access. And, you know, again, with the creativity and help of many of you in this room, looking at market mechanisms, looking at cash and voucher approaches that circumvent the need to move a very heavy footprint of commodities in. And I think, as you know, these are all circumventing what are problems that need a systemic response, but as the humanitarian community always does, working together to find those more immediate solutions. On the development front, I was very pleased to hear this raised as one of the critical issues. About 2 years ago, when I was relatively newly in this job, I traveled to Darfur and met with some IDP families in a camp who had been there for, I think at that time, about 7 or 8 years. And one of the women said, you know, if I see another hygiene kit coming at me, I'm going to scream. You know, she's there, and you know, there obviously are huge political constraints in Darfur, but there are also ways in which, by being more creative, one can find ways to help the beginnings of, I won't say it's a durable solution, but I think we can do a better job of moving more quickly to the kinds of approaches that help families in these protracted situations, particularly when they're not moving around like they are in the Congo, to have a life that is a bit more normal, especially when they're out of the heat of conflict, as many of the IDPs in Darfur are. Most importantly, this leads to how we're trying to look at really harnessing the whole of our resources across the government. So the first one thing that I'm very pleased that we're doing, and I know you all have eagerly awaited this, is, you know, we have a 2004 USAID IDP policy that is very outdated. It was done before the cluster systems, for example. So we are in the midst of tackling that, to update it and to revise that. And one of the things that that will do, and for those of you who have heard us talk about our resilience policy, one of the most important things that our resilience policy did was to create greater connectivity between our humanitarian and our development teams and enable them to sit together in what we're calling joint planning cells and look at what is the problem that we jointly need to solve. And in many countries, it's addressing the needs of internally displaced populations. So we have through the IDP policy, connecting to our resilience policy, we have a pathway to create much stronger connective tissue. And in fact, that's already underway in some of our work in the Horn and the Sahel. And we look forward to deepening that. Secondly, is we are doing jointly with the State Department a vision paper. And this is a joint goal of creating better ways of harnessing the whole of our resources to address the specific needs of IDPs, and in particular, understanding the legal and policy implications that often accompany these problems. And again, going back to the Sudan, South Sudan arena, without the partnership of Dane Smith and Princeton Lyman, we would not have been able to keep the IDP issue so front and center in this, a lot of the negotiations that were going forward. Ultimately, these are political problems, particularly when you are in a protracted situation. So it is imperative that we are all working together on looking at the ways in which we can address these problems. So these are two very concrete new ways, on top of the ongoing creative, innovative ways to address the problems with the immediate tools that we have at hand. We're also looking to connect it up better to both development and diplomacy initiatives. And we very much, over the coming year, welcome your participation, your ideas. We will be doing a consultative process for both the AID policy and the joint vision paper. And we know there's lots of good thoughts in this community. And so let me just end with a request that you very much join us in that effort. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Nancy. We turn to Elizabeth, and thank you for stepping in.
Oh, thank you so much for having us. Frank, Nancy, thank you so much for your comments. Forgive me if I actually read some of these remarks, because our Assistant Secretary Ann Richard very much wanted to be here today to indicate my Bureau, Population, Refugees, and Migration's commitment to IDPs. I want to make sure I accurately reflect her sentiments. But I did want to thank you, and congratulations to the Norwegian Refugee Council and the IDMC for an excellent global report. The State Department looks forward to this report every year, my Bureau, of course, but also throughout the State Department. We use it as a basis for our human rights reports. We do include a section now on the status of IDPs, and we really appreciate the analysis, the identification of trends, and the report's useful way of framing the global issues. I have to begin with Syria, although I do think it's appropriate that the reason Anne can't be here today is that she was in Colombia looking at the largest population of IDPs in the world. But Syria eclipses a lot of things for us today. We see millions displaced because they are fleeing fighting between the regime and the opposition. Latest estimates are 80,000 dead, 4.25 million displaced inside Syria, and 1.5 million refugees. In this case, the government is not only failing to help internally displaced persons, it is slaughtering them. Troops attack civilians, people are bombed indiscriminately from the sky, hospitals and bakeries are targeted. International organizations, as you all know, are trying to reach everyone in need, but gaining access to them is very challenging. John Ging from the Office of the Coordination of Humanitarian Assistance, OCHA, tried to lead a convoy from Damascus to Aleppo, but had to pass 54 checkpoints manned by the regime and different opposition factions along the route. The U.S. very much supports efforts to get across borders and into Syria, but this too is very difficult to do, and more is needed. I do want to pass along some impressions directly from Anne that she wanted to share fresh from her return from Colombia and Ecuador. In Colombia, Anne met with government officials who are very concerned about the 4.9 or more million Colombian IDPs. There, the government of President Santos is trying to do the right thing and implement a far-reaching victims law. And so examples of how local governments are trying to provide IDPs with the range of aid they need to restart their lives and to begin to recover from the horrors they have experienced. So in some ways, the Colombia approach could serve as a model for other countries, certainly with regard to the seriousness with which it has examined the needs of IDPs and in the breadth of the services it aims to deliver to them. In other ways, the Colombia approach is unique to Colombian laws, its constitution, and its own bureaucracy. So Assistant Secretary Richard cautions that she remains concerned about the situation that people are confronting every day in Colombia. In both countries, Ecuador and Colombia, she met people who were newly displaced. Most had fled intimidation and threats. One woman had left when her restaurant was blown up by a grenade. A couple who farmed fled when they were given a choice, either agree to cook for combatants of illegal armed groups or leave within a half an hour. Another family was indebted to members of criminal groups and fled after receiving death threats. They became IDPs in Colombia. They were tracked down and threatened a second time, so they fled to Ecuador. So all of the good work being done by the Colombian government is deserving of praise, but the continuing conflict and uncertain prospects for a true and comprehensive peace are cause still for serious concern. So today, IDMC did ask us to focus on the role of UNHCR in responding to internal displacement. As most of you know, UNHCR is PRM's largest partner. It has an essential role to play in responding to the humanitarian needs of conflict-affected IDPs. UNHCR has the lead in the areas of protection, emergency shelter, and camp coordination and management. We've heard sobering news today that the global number of IDPs is larger than ever before, and that 6.5 million persons became newly displaced in their home countries this year. This only underscores the point that UNHCR's responsibilities continue to grow. UNHCR and all of us involved in humanitarian relief have to get this right. The international system to assist and protect IDPs depends on all parties being able to fulfill their roles in the cluster system, including UNHCR. At last count, UNHCR was the lead agency for about 30 clusters in nearly 20 countries. This means that UNHCR is shouldering responsibility to protect or assist more than 15 million IDPs worldwide. PRM believes that UNHCR should allocate its resources based first and foremost on humanitarian need, not on the classification of beneficiary populations. We do not believe that IDPs are somehow a secondary priority. UNHCR possesses a set of commitments to IDPs, and these commitments should not be a lower priority for the agency relative to its other populations of concern, the more well-known refugees, returnees, and stateless persons. UNHCR's commitment to all of its protection and assistance responsibilities, including those for internally displaced persons under the cluster system, must be resolute and steadfast. We are communicating this perspective regularly and consistently to UNHCR at multiple levels, from the High Commissioner and Deputy High Commissioner to mid-level management and field staff. We will continue to do so publicly and privately. As you may know, last year we issued a public statement at UNHCR's Executive Committee, EXCOM, meeting about the need for UNHCR to be resolute toward its IDP responsibilities. Last February, PRM discussed UNHCR's commitment to IDPs during a day-long dialogue between PRM and UNHCR, led by Deputy Assistant Secretary Catherine Wiesner. And earlier this month, Assistant Secretary Richard raised this issue again with High Commissioner Guterres in an extended discussion on this issue. UNHCR officials have regularly assured us that they are committed to their IDP responsibilities. UNHCR has told us that their recent cutbacks in IDP programs are largely confined to activities that fall outside UNHCR's designated cluster duties. PRM will monitor UNHCR's program decisions in that field very carefully, and we welcome input from NGO colleagues about what they are seeing as well. Let's turn to finances. During the past 3 years, that is 2010, 11, and 12, UNHCR's total expenditures for assistance and protection of IDPs was $1.1 billion combined for the 3 years. UNHCR divides its budget into four categories or pillars, one budget category for refugees, one budget category for stateless issues, one budget category for reintegration programs, and the fourth category for IDPs. UNHCR spent $1.1 billion in that fourth category over the past 3 years. We will continue to analyze whether this is sufficient in our discussions with UNHCR, but the point I want to make today is that considerable UNHCR resources have gone to assist and protect IDPs in recent years. That is more than $1 billion. And PRM gives UNHCR the flexibility to exercise its best judgment about how to allocate the USG contribution based on the humanitarian needs that UNHCR sees in the field, whether they be refugees, IDPs, stateless persons, or returnees. PRM's contributions to UNHCR give that agency the ability to shift U.S. government funding among budget categories and into IDP programs that may need more support. A substantial portion of the $1.1 billion that UNHCR has spent on IDP field operations in the past 3 years has come from the United States government. Even with the new refugee populations emerging around the world, we believe that UNHCR needs to ensure that all its staff members at all levels understand the agency's commitment to IDP responsibilities, particularly staff in the field, and when future budgets are being planned. At PRM, we are paying close attention to UNHCR's budget data that show how UNHCR spends its resources. We look forward very soon to receiving from UNHCR its final expenditure report for 2012, which will show how much UNHCR spent last year in each budget category, including for IDP programs. We will work with UNHCR to try to ensure that it is meeting the most urgent humanitarian needs as tight budgets face tough choices. PRM will continue to urge stronger UNHCR leadership of the Global Protection Cluster as well as more effective and consistent UNHCR leadership of clusters at the country level. UNHCR needs to ensure that its personnel have the specialized training and experience they need to serve as cluster coordinators in IDP emergencies. And yes, within PRM, we will have work to do as well. We need to make sure that we convey a consistent and coherent message to UNHCR that we expect UNHCR to meet its IDP responsibilities. As I said earlier, I believe we are already doing that in private and in public statements. And if some of you see specific examples where PRM needs to do this better, please let us know. We at PRM Washington will make the point of working with our staff in the field to closely track UNHCR's work with IDPs and UNHCR's performance within the cluster system. One way we are doing this is through our twice-yearly review of UNHCR's country operation plans. This process results in findings that we convey directly to UNHCR headquarters and throughout the year. And thirdly, PRM will continue to strengthen coordination with our colleagues at USAID. As Nancy has said, our teams and leadership work very closely together. We have traveled together to communicate and coordinate well. We now have an interagency humanitarian policy working group that includes PRM, USAID's Bureau for Democracy, Conflict, and Humanitarian Assistance, State Department's Bureau of International Organizations, and the Bureau of Foreign Assistance. In addition, of course, our colleagues in New York and Geneva. For 2013, our interagency working group decided to focus our policy efforts on a handful of issues, one of which is UNHCR's commitment to IDP issues. So this is not only a PRM priority, it's a collective priority for all of us. So in conclusion, humanitarian budgets are tight. The Syria emergency is particularly stretching resources beyond anything we have ever seen before. The international community has to make sure that the assistance and protection for IDPs around the world does not fall backward. We need to continue to strengthen the system of response. We all realize that multiple UN agencies, not only UNHCR, have responsibilities in IDP emergencies. But at PRM, we also recognize that UNHCR has been charged with playing a hugely important role, and the well-being of millions of IDPs depends in part on UNHCR living up to those responsibilities. So we pledge to continue working closely. I want to thank Brookings for hosting this event. There's no better place in Washington to unveil a report on IDPs. The Brookings IDP Project is an important actor in Washington and internationally on IDP policies. We're well aware that the Brookings IDP Project provides essential support to the work of the UN Special Rapporteur on the Human Rights of Internally Displaced Persons. So thank you again for that. Brookings briefings and supports, some of which are critical of USG policies, always have our attention and respect. When Brookings points out ways the USG should do better, we listen closely. Thank you again on behalf of Assistant Secretary Richard.
Thank you very much, Elizabeth. We turn now to Joel.
Okay. So, Beth, thanks for having me and the opportunity to address this topic. And thank you to IDMC for your role in monitoring the situation for internally displaced people globally. This session is being, like, filmed, right? It's being recorded. It's being videoed.
Yes.
Okay, that's excellent. Because we've heard some just really positive, forward-leaning statements from both USAID and PRM, which are basically music to my ears, I hope to all of your ears. You know, we're going to have a new IDP policy. We're going to have a framework between USAID and the State Department as it relates to a unified USG response on internal displacement. and we're sending an unequivocal message to UNHCR that internal displacement is important, they need to step up, and that flexible funding is available for them to do so. So I feel like we can just end the meeting and, you know, just... those messages I think are really important, and you know, something that we in civil society need to monitor to make sure that they're followed through on. 2012 marked the 20th anniversary of the establishment of the mandate for the representative of the Secretary General, now Special Rapporteur attached to the Human Rights Council on internal displacement, and as Beth knows, we held a sort of review or reflection session in Geneva last November with the current and previous mandate holders, as well as others involved in supporting the mandate and engaging on the internal displacement issue, to kind of look back and say, what have we achieved and where are we with this issue right now? And while there was general agreement that from a 20-year perspective, progress had been made, notably the landmark achievement of the guiding principles, we also agreed that momentum to address the problems of internal displacement had slowed. In fact, it slowed considerably, and that in some ways it had all but disappeared from the global discourse as an issue of concern. So I'd like to open a discussion among the panel, but also among the audience. Why is this the case? I mean, first, you agree that we're losing momentum. And then secondly, if you have speculation as to why this might be the case and how we can kind of turn this situation around. I'm going to cite five factors. I'm sure there may be others. One is an ironic one of sort of the perils of success. There's a perception that via the guiding principles and via the humanitarian reform effort led by Jan Egeland in 2005, that we kind of solved this problem. And maybe it didn't need the kind of dedicated attention that the issue received, you know, from the early 90s until 2005. A second factor I would cite would be the perils of mainstreaming. Mainstreaming is fine up to a point. But without vigilance, mainstreaming can become the equivalent of disappearing. Where is the focused advocacy for response to the special vulnerabilities, of the internally displaced? And that links to the third concern or factor, which is, I think there's still a residual concern, despite the massive effort of, you know, Beth, your project and the mandate holders and IDMC and all of us that have worked on this issue, there's still concern of privileging one category of vulnerable person over another. The argument is basically the focus should be on the most vulnerable, period. There's still some reluctance to accept the idea that the internally displaced indeed require special protection efforts. So, I mean, I could cite many examples, but I'm going to cite OCHA here as an example. There's no longer an IDP unit, a dedicated IDP unit within the Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs. That relates to sort of the perils of mainstreaming. But then you see very little reference in OCHA materials and in Valerie Amos's statements around internally displaced people as, you know, sort of a special category of vulnerable population. So these two issues mesh and reinforce each other. The fourth factor I would cite is the whole phenomenon of urban displacement and sort of being lost among the masses. The famous visit of Ambassador Richard Holbrooke to Angola in 2000, what motivated his activism on the issue was the contrast between a camp for Congolese refugees and a camp for Angolan internally displaced people. With the trend away from camps, and I'm not saying that that's bad, but the trend away from camps, which is fully understandable and justified, makes the problem less visible. We don't have those iconic images that we may have had 10 or 15 years ago. And then I do think, despite PRM's efforts that we've heard about, I think we just have to accept the fact that there's a lack of a clear, agreed international mandate holder for protection and response to internal displacement. And I do think UNHCR and donors, certainly if we take a 5 or 10 year perspective on this, have been schizophrenic on the appropriate role of the refugee agency. There's been mixed messages conveyed. There's still traditional thinking within UNHCR. And then the sheer scale of the displacement problem are all issues. So, I mean, in fairness to UNHCR, there is almost a question of triage here. And they can't always, you know, they're under tremendous budget pressure and tremendous pressure given the numbers. So what could be done in the face of this? How can we kind of revive the momentum? One is I do think we need to renew dedicated research and advocacy around the special vulnerabilities of internally displaced people, being as case-specific as possible. We can't assume that everyone's going to understand that internally displaced people have special needs. Second, we need to support the African Union technically and with funding as needed to enable it to, you know, fully realize the potential of the Kampala Convention and make sure that it comes into force in an effective way. Third, donors need to send an unequivocal message backed up with funding. The UNHCR has a pivotal role to play in leading the response to the protection and assistance needs of internally displaced people, and that goes beyond their cluster responsibilities because of the sheer capacity that they have to mobilize an effective response on the assistance side. I've already alluded at the outset, and again, this is music to my ears, the U.S. needs to rewrite the 2004 IDP policy, which is clearly outmoded. But again, whether you call it a policy or a framework, it's vital that this be a U.S. government-wide policy, that it be more than something that's lodged within USAID, but there's an agreed approach across the government on internal displacement, and that's especially important given, frankly, the confusion that the QDDR created around who's responsible for what in U.S. government emergency response. And then finally, and Nancy, you'll, I'm sure, be pleased to hear this, yes, get the development agencies involved. Factor, but not in the sense of like, so my argument there is it's not that humanitarians need to become development actors. It's that the development agencies in cooperation with host governments need to factor internal displacement into planning and address areas and populations that are confronting protracted internal displacement. So get the development actors to recognize the importance of this issue just from a national planning and national development perspective. That's going to need the World Bank. That's going to need UNDP, the other UN development agencies, the development wings of donor governments, but also very essentially the host states themselves in terms of being able to see this problem and respond to it.
Thank you very much, Joel, and thanks to all of you. I mean, I think these have been dynamite presentations, all four of them. And as Joel said, we're delighted to hear about the efforts of the U.S. government to continue to uphold the particular needs of IDPs through a policy and work on the national level through your advocacy with UNHCR. Last week, I was talking with a major European donor, and I said, what are you doing about IDPs? And the response was, well, UNHCR has to focus on its core mandate of refugees. And if there's money left over, then we can worry about IDPs. So it's really refreshing to hear that the policy of the U.S. government is quite different. Maybe before we open it up for questions, I might just pose each of you a little question, since chairs get to do that sometimes. The IDMC, how do you define protracted? You know, when you say 90% of IDPs are in protracted situations, is that for lasting more than 5 years, or is it situations where there's a political stalemate and solutions seem elusive? And for Nancy, this concept of resilience, how would you see resilience in IDPs? What would be the main thrust of an argument? And to Elizabeth, what suggestions would you give for approaching other donors who don't have this policy toward UNHCR? As you mentioned, your unearmarked funding, or some of your unearmarked funding for UNHCR, allows it to devote those resources to IDPs. But is that just balancing off the many donors who say this is for IDPs only? And for Joel, I think you've made a passionate remarks on the policies of the U.S. government. But what about NGOs? My sense is that for NGOs, IDPs are somehow slipping off the agenda, aren't as visible as they have been. So maybe after those brief questions, we'll open it up for a larger discussion. You want to start, Frank?
Yes, I guess the protracted situation, what's protracted and what's not, I mean, is this sort of a definitional question that's linked to the way we see it, I think. When the humanitarian phase is over, when the immediate risks and threats to life are sort of no longer there, it would be a protracted situation. Sometimes it's to do with a political stalemate. You get situations like Azerbaijan, like Georgia. Right. And sometimes, you know, it's a situation where a community has just been in limbo for a long time and they're unable to return. They're just stuck there, if you like. Mm-hmm. So it's to do as much with the support mechanisms that will allow them to go back than anything else. But yeah, good question.
Okay. And that ties directly, I think, into the whole questions of resilience and particularly the engagement of development actors. Mm-hmm. Nancy?
You know, the when we started with our resilience approach, we were really looking at where are we year after year putting in considerable humanitarian funding, and there's no movement, there's no ability of those communities to move out of a state of constant crisis. And certainly, if you look around the globe, most of those protracted crises have a significant IDP component. Mm-hmm. And so the question is, where are those places where it can be solved through assistance mechanisms, and where are they fundamentally political problems? On the former, there are lots of ways in which, through the processes that we're setting up, there are opportunities to bring, and I agree with you, Joel, it's very much about putting this on the development agenda, and I think it is similar to all the ways in which we're saying we've got to be taking account into our development thinking the risks and the vulnerabilities that would otherwise threaten to undercut our development gains. And if populations are so vulnerable that they are likely to be displaced because they have not enough assets to stay where they are when a drought hits, or there's conflict that's not managed by the state that pushes them out, those risks will undercut your development investments. Mm-hmm. And so it is imperative for the development community to be factoring this in to strategies and approaches. And that's the heart of the resilience agenda. And so where you have protracted or repeated or threats of large displacements, that has to be a part of the analysis. And that's what we're seeking to do with the resilience approach. And just an additional comment I would make, and I think it goes to a number of the comments you made, Joel, and that is it is a big difference between, in my opinion, the kind of ways in which one provides assistance to IDPs. And and that includes helping them with ways to be more resilient or development options. But in the protracted crises, it's the legal issues and the diplomatic work and the political solutions that are fundamental to that. Mm-hmm. And there are lots of agencies and lots of UN groups that do assistance, but it's really bearing down on how we solve this. And there's no easy answer. Mm-hmm. I mean, everybody's been working as hard as possible on almost all of these long access, difficult crises, mm-hmm. and it's moving on that. And part of that, I think, is continuing to push forward norms so that when you're outside of those norms, you get increasing pariah status.
Thank you, Elizabeth.
Well, the issue of donor coordination and trying to encourage donors is sort of a chronic one for us. And I think we go about it in creative ways. In some instances, it's worth just taking the notoriety or the political importance of an issue like Syria and encouraging donors to give, whether it's to the refugees or the IDPs, but to give to the effort. We also have instances where governments, typically in the Gulf states, don't really want to give through the UN system, but that's can be coordinated within the system, and again, it can respond to people in need. So we can be creative and ad hoc about it. On the other hand, as you say, we have forum in which we discuss the long-term our long-term policy on assistance, the importance of giving to the most vulnerable. Sometimes those are difficult discussions to have. Burden sharing is always a tough one. And our government certainly is always has that in the back of our mind, making sure that we do not assume sole responsibility for the world's crises. But so I think the answer is we're doing it in both places, both sort of at the Brussels, Geneva side, but also when we have an emergency, when we have a crisis, we don't care as much about whether they're giving to the IDP end or to the to the refugee end.
Thank you. And Joel?
Yeah, I'm glad you asked that question because I indeed, on the way to work this morning, I recalled our the letter to the newly elected Obama administration that we put together in December 2008. So I figured I'd better pull this out and see what we said. And, you know, but what's striking in the context of your question is not so much what we said, but the fact that we had 22 NGOs that were signing on to this letter to the Obama administration around what it should do related to internal displacement, you know, both policy and operational matters. And in all honesty, if we tried to pull together a similar process right now, I'm not sure we could get 20 signatories to a letter like that. And the way I view it is, the operational NGOs are UNHCR in microcosm in the sense that they're completely overwhelmed by the operational challenges that they're facing, you know, Syria on top of Mali, on top of Sudan, on top of the Horn, you know, on top of Pakistan, et cetera. Mm-hmm. So as much as I would like the operational agencies to lead on the internal displacement issue based on their experience, I think that's basically unrealistic. So, you know, Frank and I had a good conversation yesterday. We want to reinvigorate IDP advocacy, but kind of with the research agencies and the advocacy agencies taking the lead in this process. I mean, quite frankly, I think there's been a lack of leadership recently and a lack of pointed advocacy around the internal displacement issue coming out of the NGO sector. But I think that has to come from the organizations that are dedicated to doing that work. And if we start to provide leadership collectively, yes, that will resonate with the operational NGOs and we can get some support and some buy-in. But absent a clear agenda and some really specific things that we're going for, yeah. I mean, the operational agencies are just going to look at this world of overwhelming need, and, you know, I understand. It's basically at that point becomes about vulnerable people and a kind of triage process in terms of where they should be working and dedicating their resources.
Thank you very much. We'll open it up now for discussion. We have microphones. And if it's okay, we'll take three or four questions, and you can direct them to an individual altogether. We'll go one, two, three, four, and then we'll have some responses. And if you could stand up and introduce yourself, the mic is coming. Yes.
I'm John Harbison, and I have an affiliation with Johns Hopkins Sites. Thank you, Frank, for all you do. Quick observation, maybe your future reports, as beautiful as they are, ought to differentiate between protracted and humanitarian ones. But my real question is, and you have all you can do with large-scale existing ID crises, but how much reconnaissance do you do on ones that you see coming, particularly if they involve smaller communities that may be in effect, whose very existence may be threatened because they're both marginal? What am I thinking about? I'm thinking about Gibby III Dam in Ethiopia that threatens populations, marginal populations in Ethiopia, threatens populations in Lake Turkana, two countries that are friends, both of them problematic democracies, both of them defense partners of the United States, where our policy is ambivalent. So how about that?
Thank you. And right behind this gentleman here.
Hi, thank you very much. My name is Adnan Sari. I'm with the Yale Journal of International Affairs. So I had a response to Joel's kind of comment about, and a question as well, about why IDPs are a bit more abstract and given less attention to refugees. This is my first event on IDPs, and something that just jumps out at me is the amount of media attention that they get. I know all about Syrian refugees in the Zaatari refugee camp, but I hardly ever hear about IDPs, and I think some of it could just be simple marketing. IDP is a very difficult thing to articulate. If there was a term, not necessarily an accurate term, but just a term that people knew intuitively what it is, like unescaped refugees, they can't take refuge, they're still in Syria, I think it would just pick up a lot faster. And we know that donors and NGOs respond to the media. So I do think that could be one thing. My question was, in contrasting the situation of IDPs with refugees, how are goals different? Is it a success when an IDP becomes a refugee? And some of the problems that we have with refugees, for example, the access of justice within refugee camps, the problem is that host countries who are responsible for justice under the UNHCR 1951 protocol often don't deliver. So you get kind of sometimes local refugee camp sourced forms of justice, but the host country is abstinent. In the situation for IDPs, the host country is often the predator. It's often the aggressor, like it is in Syria. So how would goals differ from the refugee situation? And what do successes look like that are similar to a success for a refugee situation? And how are they different?
Thank you. And right behind Kate.
Hi, thanks. Kate Phillips-Brasso with the International Rescue Committee. I was really pleased to hear Nancy in particular referring to these problems as political problems, because ultimately that's really where the source of the solution to them lies, and understanding that there'll be more coordination with the State Department and really finding a solution to this. But I think we get stuck, whether it's on atrocities prevention or dealing with IDPs or sovereignty issues in general, on the political calculus of how hard to push a country to meet its own laws, to meet conventions like the Kampala Convention. So just wanted to go a little deeper into that in terms of what can be done on the U.S. government level to kick this up in terms of the priority list. We have a lot of different things that go into the political calculus with different countries, whether those are concerns about counterterrorism, trade policy, regional policy, et cetera. And a lot of times, you know, obviously we have tremendous commitment among people who've dedicated their careers to these issues in the U.S. government, but there's a lot of factors at play. Will it require something more, whether an executive order or legislation or something to articulate that this really does matter, even when we need to push countries that, frankly, are useful to us or we need to act in certain ways because of other reasons?
Thank you. And the gentleman over here.
Thank you. John Thorn Majuk, I'm a South Sudanese American. As someone who has been an IDP and a refugee for more than 13 years, these issues touch my heart. One of my questions is, at what point, if refugees are more protected than the IDP, at what point do IDP then become refugee, and what role does the international community play in this? Because I live in refugee camp, in two refugee camps, and then I became IDP and then become a refugee again until I came to this country through PRM collaboration with UNHCR. And so it's confusing for someone who has lived in both camps to see what particular role the international community play. I see refugees being more protected than IDPs, and IDPs being within their own country. You mentioned before the access to these people. It's difficult. And when I was in IDP camp, the only international agency that we saw was helping us was the International Committee of the Red Cross, which brought rations and distributed them. But when we were in refugee camp, we know UNHCR and other UN agencies. So at what point do you see IDP become more protected? Because they are suffering from the same problem, and in this context, it's conflict. Conflict displaced people. That's what I'm focusing on. And how do you really convince the government to protect their IDPs? Because some government are resistant.
Right.
Because it's the same government that is actually doing harm to their people. So how do you really, as the international community, do that? Thank you.
Thank you. Well, a variety of questions. Who would like to go first? First one gets to choose which questions you'd like to answer. Yeah, Nancy.
Yeah, no, those are all great questions. And a couple of thoughts. First of all, I have for a decade been saying no more three-letter acronym on anything, which is one of the reasons I'm so excited about the name Resilience, right? It's like the only not. I think IDPs is a very dehumanizing name, and I wish there were a way, you know, that we could have people understand that behind that name, you know, there are individuals the way refugee does. That's a good challenge for all of us. A couple of responses that blend the issues together. I mean, I when you're talking about the assistance needs, I do think it is critical that we remember how many IDPs are not in camps. And then it becomes quickly blurred the difference between the IDPs and the host communities or families who are also very often vulnerable and at risk. And so from an assistance perspective, it is important to think about it in terms of vulnerabilities. And as we map out our responses, if you aren't thinking about the host communities, and this is true for both refugees and for IDPs, you know, I think as almost any practitioner would agree, you get yourself you could create other problems. So it is, I think, the critical challenge around IDPs is exactly, sir, what you noted in terms of a combination of when you can't have access or when you don't have solutions because it's a persecuted or marginalized group within that country, or it's fundamentally a weak government that doesn't provide a framework for greater stability and equity. And for this reason, we've put a huge emphasis on something called the Fragile States New Deal. And within that, this is a G7 plus initiative that has signed up to these seven state-building, peace-building goals. A number of the countries that host a great percentage of the IDP population globally, because fundamentally, this is about governance. This is about inclusive, legitimate, democratic governments who are not providing for their people. And so if we don't think about it in addition to the assistance issues from that perspective, we will not ever address a more sustainable solution. Now, these are long-term, tricky issues. And, you know, Joel, to one of your comments, I think why it seems like there's been a stalling out is I think we got the easy wins, and we're hitting the wall of the very intractable difficult solutions that we now need to collectively push forward. But, you know, just to conclude that fundamentally we need to tackle this from both a governance perspective, inclusive, legitimate, democratic government, coupled with the kind of diplomacy and, you know, international advocacy that make it completely unacceptable for sovereignty to trump the human rights and well-being of millions and millions of vulnerable families.
Thank you. Next person would like to respond. Frank, you want to respond to the question about prevention of...
Yeah, I'll give it a crack. I'll bunch them all together because I think there's some relevance between them. I think we need to consider, you know, we talk about IDPs or this acronym. I totally agree with you. It does dehumanize. It's quite terrible. If you come up with a better name, let me know. So we've got the IDPs, we've got the refugees, we've got the people that the potential IDPs and potential refugees. What we're talking about is vulnerability, essentially. And then what we're talking about is a continuum of displacement. We forget that refugees are IDPs before they become refugees. In a certain way, some of the lucky ones become refugees, others don't manage to reach that border. And then suddenly a whole kind of international mechanism kicks in, you know, framed by the 1951 Convention with UNHCR and this access. Essentially, And the people we're talking about, the people that escape, are poor people. Let's not beat around the bush. We're not talking about wealthy people that can see danger coming and move to a second home. You know, the wealthy Syrians. I mean, I'm being crude here and simplifying, but we're talking about vulnerability and poor people who don't have the opportunity to move or don't have choices, and therefore find themselves forced to flee, rather than having to choose to flee because the situation is getting a little bit hot under the collar or whatever, the dynamics are kind of shifting. So we're talking about development issues at the outset. We're also talking about humanitarian issues, and we're talking about political issues. Those are three dimensions of the problem at all stages, and they need to be addressed as a package, if you like. You can't say, okay, now's the humanitarian moment. They were really poor, they were vulnerable, and they were potentially subject to becoming displaced IDPs and then refugees. Why wait to an extent? And we're seeing that I said I wouldn't bring in the issue of natural hazards, but certainly that's one of the issues that people recognize. It's easy to recognize that. But in conflict-affected fragile states, you could argue that those sort of drivers of displacement are equally predictable, in a sense, coming back to, you know, what the gentleman said there. Why not respond, you know, politically or, you know, to try and reduce the risk of conflicts emerging in the first place, which would be a sort of, you know, rights-based intervention, political intervention, stroke development intervention. So I think that we need to consider this. We need to sort of review these kind of silos and try and sort of take a more comprehensive approach. And I think that, coming back to one of the comments at the back, that requires a sort of more comprehensive policy response from donors and from governments to ensure that frequently what happens is that there's a schizophrenic split within governments where certain departments are encouraging sort of linkages with the government through trade links and through, you know, a whole set, through no fault of their own. I mean, I'm not saying this is bad or good, but it's out of sync with maybe some of the political desires of other departments, and they sort of this sort of, how can I say, there's a slight disconnect between what one government department is doing and another government department is doing, and sometimes mixed messages are received at the other end, and that could be sort of something that could be tightened up. But I mean, you know, in large bureaucracies, it's going to be very complicated. I wouldn't want your job, Nancy. That's what I can say. But yeah, I just think if we can consider this as a continuum rather than as a sort of moment in time with its own sort of set of interventions, I think that would be a more honest perception and response.
Joel, so. Elizabeth?
Could I just follow on to what Frank was saying? I think that for PRM, from PRM's perspective, that's exactly what we are trying to do within the Department of State, and then in conjunction with our AID partners in the U.S. government. That is, ensure that humanitarian response and humanitarian policy becomes part of diplomacy in a very prominent way. And I can think of some successes, actually. You can always think of failures. But I do think that in the Iraq context, as we were several years ago trying very hard to make the new government of Iraq a success and stable, we were able to introduce, I think through advocacy from NGO community, our own civil society, through articulate people like Nancy Lindborg and others, we did make sure that our Iraq policy included a response to IDP issues, refugee issues certainly, and there's the famous resettlement program. But I do think that we were able to introduce into the conversation the fact that unless IDPs had a durable solution, unless IDPs felt that they had found a new home or could go back to former homes in Iraq, there would not be a stability that we were seeking in a national security sense. So I think that that conversation obviously continues, but we have been able to get it into the agenda successfully and I think in a sustainable way. And in Syria, as the political solution eludes us, we are certainly putting humanitarian response and responsibilities at the forefront. I mean, anytime Secretary Kerry or the president mentions this crisis. I think that there are the very central to his message, their messages, is our responsibility to the humanitarian crisis and how, and ways to ensure that the people are find a long-term solution. At this stage, thankfully, we're not considering resettlement of Syrians. We're hoping for a better solution than that, but it's front and center. But the efforts continue, and that's something that I know Assistant Secretary Richard is intent on doing, keeping that conversation very central in the State Department.
Joe?
Just in terms of goals with as it relates to internally displaced people, I mean, I think, and these are not phases, they take place simultaneously. When people in the immediate aftermath of displacement, there's just a very basic protection challenge. So, you know, there has to be a capability, and that's not going to come from the host government because, as you point out, often it's the host government that's forcing the displacement. So there has to be some capability somewhere within probably the international system to provide that kind of immediate life-saving assistance. But thinking of a place like the Eastern Congo, at the very same time that people are being forced out of their communities by violence, there are literally tens of thousands of internally displaced people who've been displaced for years, who count within the numbers, yet are fundamentally within communities. I'm thinking of Eastern Burma as well. So at the very same time, you have to have that immediate protection capacity. You do have to be, on the one hand, pushing the host government, and on the other hand, initiating a community-level development process that's inclusive of the needs of internally displaced people, which I think is more or less feasible depending on how polarized the political context is. I mean, if you look at Eastern Burma right now, I mean, there, I wouldn't go so far as to put IDP in quotes, but I mean, there are people who count in the numbers who've now been living in the same communities 6 kilometers from their original village for literally a decade. Are they IDPs the way we think of it? Yes, legally, I suppose they are, but they're fundamentally integrated now into new communities. So what are their vulnerabilities and how can we approach that? So, I mean, I think it gets pretty complicated, but it is the minute you get away from that immediate protection thing, you do get into some kind of development or integrating process that needs to be approached as holistically as possible.
Thanks. We'll take some more questions. I might say, as we're waiting for the microphone, you know, displacement is messy. I mean, refugees returned to Afghanistan can't go home and become IDPs. You have long-standing protracted displacement in Colombia, solutions for some, and new displacements occurring at the same time. Mm-hmm. Let's see, the woman here. Yes, Joan?
Hi, Joan Timoney, Women's Refugee Commission. Joel, this is a question for you, I think. You mentioned when you were listing things that need to be done, you were talking about UNHCR and saying it should go even beyond its specific cluster responsibilities. And I wondered if you could expand on that a little bit, because I was actually thinking, I think all of us were very excited, Elizabeth, to hear such a strong statement from PRM. I thought that was great. So now we sort of have an unequivocal statement about the role of HCR on these issues. That's terrific. It's like, how do we build on that? And I'm thinking, in practically speaking, do we have, and thinking about the gaps that UNHCR has in meeting its own cluster responsibilities, do we do better to marry such a strong statement with much greater advocacy with HCR around its immediate cluster responsibilities? Will that achieve more rather than saying, and then other things as well? And then secondly, if you say other things as well, are there actually other agencies that, in theory, under the cluster system, are responsible for those other things, so that you sort of, in effect, undermine accountability within the cluster system for those other agencies and what they ought to be doing? So just trying to understand more what you meant there. Thank you.
Okay, do we have another couple questions? Way at the back and then here at the front. Back there? Yes, the woman right there, yes.
Thank you very much. I'm Tanya Schwimmer. I manage the Somalia NGO Consortium. I
know. Can you speak up a little bit, please?
Okay, sorry. I have a concrete question to Nancy, I guess. In Somalia, we have a massive crisis, as many of you know. We have 2.7 million people still in need of humanitarian life-saving assistance. We have over 2 million people displaced, and we have over 1 million refugees outside of the country. Resilience is increasingly seen as the silver bullet that can fix many of the problems. But what is striking is that very little money is available for resilience programming. Very little money is available for any form of development programming. And striking is also that IDPs are largely excluded from resilience programming. Instead, money is spent on stabilization, on direct assistance to a government that is increasingly fighting to stay, eligible and to keep the warlords under control. So my question would be, could you maybe expand a little bit on what concrete actions the government or USAID is doing to increase the resilience portfolio and to ensure that IDPs are meaningfully consulted? For instance, in Mogadishu, where we do have slightly increased access and a massive IDP population that is increasingly completely excluded from any form of programming. Also, it would be great to hear from you, can more be done to ensure that the rather fragmented donor government approach to IDPs, to resilience, is more harmonized, that we have a collective approach rather than a piecemeal ad hoc approach. And then obviously more significant funding for resilience type of interventions. You also mentioned the New Deal. Thank you, and then I will be quiet. The New Deal is a fantastic concept on paper. It's looking very promising, and it gives civil society a tool to ask and hold people accountable. But again, in Somalia, civil society is almost 100% excluded from any planning around the New Deal. So again, it would be fantastic to hear, are there concrete plans to improve the situation?
Thank you very much. And when we come to that question, maybe we could repeat it because it was difficult to hear. Yes, sir?
Thank you very much. My name is Fakhreddin Ismailov. I'm from the Embassy of Azerbaijan. I have two observations, and I would kindly ask Mr. Smith probably the comments or the on that. First, on general nature, on protracted conflict, the fact is that more the crisis is protracting, the less and less international attention is devoted to the situation. And it's also the case that the number of the pages, spaces that are devoted to the protracted conflicts is shrinking from the year to another in the report devoted to the IDPs. Actually, we'll lose the sense of urgency to find lasting solution to the situation. This is something that very much regrettable from the point of those IDPs who are willing to return back to their homeland. The second regarding, my second observation is dealing specifically with Azerbaijan. My country has been facing a huge IDP crisis for more than 20 years due to the occupation of 20% of its land by the neighbor in Armenia. Even though the report takes into account the measures has been taken by the government for several years, but this part ends up with a number of new obstacles and problems. Somehow to put into charge of the government to do more. Certainly we are aware that we have to do more, but main principal source of these obstacles and the problems is ongoing occupation. And for those who are unaware of the crisis and haven't read this report, my thought that this is still the major source of this problem is the government and Azerbaijan itself. And it might be politically sensitive, but still we will urge the authors of the report at some point to mention that this is the lasting solution of these IDPs goes through their return in dignity and safety to their homelands, which still is under occupation. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Very diverse questions here, one on role of UNHCR beyond clusters, one on resilience in the context of Somalia, and also the participation or lack of participation of civil society there. Then a question about from Azerbaijan. Certainly, I think we'd all agree with you, the more protracted situations get less attention. I mean, Elizabeth mentioned Iraq a few years ago. There's still a million Iraqi IDPs. We don't hear about them very much, but they're still there. And the comment that in many cases it's a political solution that is leading to the protracted, or lack of a political solution leading to the protracted displacement. Joel, you want to start with UNHCR?
Sure. Joan, obviously I see where you're coming from. What What I meant basically is, I mean, I've always thought in responding to these situations to try and look who actually has the emergency response capacity in any given situation. And if you look out there within the UN system, leaving cluster responsibilities aside, if you allow me for a moment, I mean, it's basically UNHCR and World Food Program are at the core of the UN emergency response system, with UNICEF, you know, doing okay, but I fundamentally feel like in many situations, it's basically UNHCR slash WFP or nothing when it comes to an actual response, especially in the immediate displacement phase. The other place I'm coming from is, you know, I think we've been disappointed in the functioning of the protection cluster as a cluster. And one response to that would be, we'll step up and provide better leadership to the cluster. But another possible response is, this is a bureaucratic sinkhole that isn't leading anywhere, that isn't leading to actual protection of people. Therefore, let's focus on what your actual emergency response capacity is in any given situation. So that, you know, so that's kind of where I'm coming from. I mean, definitely take your point about potentially undermining accountability within the cluster system, but this is more an idea of, well, let's take a pragmatic view. Where does the capacity lie with any given situation? And I'd like to think that often that capacity lies with UNHCR and is either untapped or not mobilized to the extent that it could be.
Thank you. Nancy, on the resilience in Somalia question?
Yeah, thanks for that question. It's a great question, and it's one that we're tackling because it's critical and it's tough. We set out for ourselves at USAID as a goal for 2013 to look at how in places like Somalia you bring the resilience agenda with its framework into focus with the New Deal, with its framework, because you've got a foreground problem of a government emerging or a country emerging from two decades of conflict. So there's reconciliation and governance issues that are real foreground, and how do you couple that with a lot of the practices of the resilience approach? And so we actually have a team, you know, that is right now in Nairobi meeting on looking at how to tackle that. I have not heard that IDPs are excluded from resilience programs, and I'm not sure what that's based on, because, in fact, a lot of the programs that we have funded have taken an approach of very much focusing on IDPs and looking at how do you build the resilience, because, in fact, quite a few of them are pastoralists, which is a whole different way to think about displacement.
Since they're always displaced.
It's an interesting question, and we could go into it, but we won't right now. But we've worked very closely with a number of NGOs, and certainly FAO, WFP, and UNICEF have really taken up the resilience approach, and we are continuing to work with them. On the development of the New Deal Compact, there was a meeting in London on May 7th, and that is now underway as we speak. And I will definitely look into the degree to which civil society is commenting or not, because that is meant to be a part of how these things are developed, and that is certainly the intention. So I don't know, but we can look into that. And then finally, in terms of the funding, I think as everybody in this room is keenly aware, we have had sequestration fall upon the U.S. government, and that's having a huge impact on our funding. Nonetheless, we are looking at how to carve out additional funds specifically for Somalia, and specifically looking at how to increase the resilience programming and how to connect that with the New Deal approaches. So we're aware of that need and trying to fix that.
Thanks.
So all good questions. We share those concerns.
Thanks. Elizabeth, Frank, final comments before we close?
I can come back on Azerbaijan. I was there last week. So that's the question's very timely. Or maybe your presence. yes, as Beth said, it's a political situation. It's quite ironic that the government of Azerbaijan has got a lot of oil wealth, but can only offer the potential for two of the three durable solutions, the three durable solutions being local integration, relocation to another part of the country, or return to place of origin. Now, I don't think you can divide those three options. It's either you've got the three options and that's a durable solution, or you don't have the three options. And there's been a lot of criticism of certain governments for promoting return as the only durable solution. So, you know, we'll get IDPs off our book if they can return. Now, in the case of Azerbaijan, that's not an option. So the possibility of a durable solution, especially in the context of a situation where you've got Security Council resolutions calling for the withdrawal of Armenian troops from the territories they occupy, means that that possibility can't be offered. Now, there is a political, if you like, impasse for the Azerbaijani government. If you try to integrate everybody, you're almost conceding politically those occupied territories to Armenia. So I can understand, and that's nothing to do with me, those are political questions, but I can sort of sympathize with the political complexity and the position that the Azerbaijani government is in. I don't know what to say. It's a political situation, and it can only be resolved at the highest political levels. There isn't enough attention on the situation there, and that's a shame, really, because I think it would be in everybody's benefit for that to be resolved as soon as possible.
Thank you. Elizabeth, final word?
Just to say that there are a lot of protracted situations around the world. They may fall off the front pages, but do be assured that we look at all populations when we make our budget decisions. For instance, we still have about a $200 million budget that goes to Iraqi refugees and IDPs, despite the fact that it's fallen from the front pages. So our bureau, and I know AID, looks very carefully at these populations every year.
Well, thank you all very much for coming, and please join me in thanking our panelists.